a typical day in that time, it was, I would go out 4 hours in the morning, and 3 of those hours I'd have to do it like 300 watts and then come back. And then it was in the program, it was nap. So I'd go take an hour nap. And then I would ride to the gym and I'd do like a full lifting session. And I'd get back on the bike and I'd do intervals on the bike. And like looking back now, I'm like, I couldn't make it through 3 months, you know?
It's showtime, everybody! Showtime!
You've been living in a dream world, Neo. Yeah. This is the world as it exists today.
Life moves pretty fast. You don't stop and look around once in a while. You could miss it.
Listen, we talking about practice.
They peed on the dude's rug.
Donnie, you're out of your element.
I see. You think this has nothing to do with you.
Don't ever trash talk Black Jesus.
This is the Adventure Stash with Payson McKelvin.
Hey everybody, welcome back. Hello from a very gray, drizzly day here in Girona, Spain. Finally, they're having a pretty gnarly drought here. Trails are very powdery, reservoirs low, and I have a rest day, so it's a great day for it to rain, in my opinion. I did see Ben Healy all suited up in rain gear, ready to roll out for presumably a real training day, but he'll be fine. He's from Ireland. Speaking of World Tour riders, we have another, Lawson Craddock, someone I go way back with. Before diving into a little bit more background on that and getting into the episode, I do want to quickly acknowledge that I know we have had way more male guests than female since getting here to Girona. That's not on purpose. We've had lots of great ongoing back and forth with some potential female guests. But just by chance, it's been a little trickier to schedule those. Couple of the ladies that I will be recording with soon are off racing right now. A couple other conversations have just kind of fizzled out, and I never want to like push someone to do the podcast. You know, I want there to be enthusiasm on both sides. So we will be getting more female guests soon in the coming weeks, and we're always striving for a good split there and good diversity roster wise. So. Just a heads up on that. In the meantime, though, Lawson Craddock, someone who very legitimately I grew up racing with. I lined up for my first ever road race when I was 15 years old, right near my house in the hill country of Texas with Lawson. That's kind of where I first got to know him a little bit. And I've, of course, followed his career ever since. We've stayed in some contact. But it's really more in the last couple of years that we've gotten to know each other a bit better, just going on training rides here in Girona. He comes from Houston, Texas, and we spend a lot of time discussing how in the world someone from the flatlands of Southeast Texas works their way towards doing battle across the high mountains of the Tour de France. This is a really good one. He's really well-spoken for one and just has awesome stories. And we ran out of time. This would have been a great like hour and a half, 2 hour episode, but our normal studio, Casa Athletic in the old town of Girona, was not available today. So we had to make do with kind of a co-working space downtown. Sound quality isn't quite as good. There's definitely some background noise here and there. I'm sorry for that. And we had to be out of there at 8 p.m. So we had more to talk about, and I think we may pick up the conversation again where we left off. We didn't get to things like Lawson's TT prowess. He's done some incredible time trials over the years, being 2-time time trial national champion and having some great international results. We don't talk about some of his amazing KOM hunting stories from both his winter training grounds in Austin and here in Girona. Some great stories that he and I have chatted about while riding together didn't make it into this show. So hopefully we'll have some time to do another one. His season starts very soon, but I'm glad we could get him in before that. So thank y'all so much for listening, and we will catch you after the show. All right, Lawson, we are somewhere in downtown Girona.
Ish, yeah. Somewhere in Spain.
Not the studio in Old Town where we have been doing these. It wasn't available today, so we're in some work space.
It's a great spot, though.
It is.
It's cozy.
It is cozy. I'm not sure how the acoustics are, but we're doing the OG setup with the little hand mics. Don't even have any mic stands. Throwing it back to like 5 years ago when we started this thing. How many podcasts? Five years.
You've done a lot more than I have.
That's true. Yeah. I've done more than most people.
Yeah, I'd say so. I've done a handful. It's been a minute though.
Yeah.
So we'll see how it goes. Good tank here.
I wish we just had mics for our bike ride the other day. We basically did just a really good podcast.
Yeah.
And we're going to kind of try to recreate most of it. Not all of it. Not all of it can be shared.
Nor should it.
But
the world's not ready for that.
Cool. So, geez, speaking of going way back, the first memory I have of you was my first ever road race.
Oh my God.
I was 15.
All right.
Belterra,
dude. That is a Texas throwback. What year would it have been?
I don't even know how old I was when I was 15.
It's funny. Belterra. So like being in Austin, I ride through Belterra all the time. Yeah. So I think back to like the races that they would put on. And I just remember that race was so hard. It forced my brother into retirement because he was 2 years older. He used to race and like we did that race. We got done with it. And he was like, I'm good. You know, I don't think I want to ride a bike anymore.
That's so funny.
So, but yeah, I mean, here we are, two Texas boys and all the way in Spain. Yeah.
Yeah. Funny. So I remember rolling, I think there were like seven kids in the junior race and it was the first year they held it. I think Belterra had like just been built.
Yeah. No
and
houses.
Yeah. So you went through the main road that goes through mm-hmm. Belterra and then you go up that steep little kicker to Sawyer Ranch.
Yeah.
But then you turned right and you took another right onto 290.
Yeah.
And they had cones set up for like half a lane.
Cars going like 70 miles
an
hour.
Oh my God, dude. In
getting
hindsight,
a little draft. Yeah.
That was probably like one of the last years you could get away with that. Now,
yeah,
no one would do that race if they
oh my God,
made
yeah.
a race on 290.
Yeah, but we were hard back then. Now we're soft.
For those that don't know, Highway 290 in the hill country of Texas, Southwest Texas, is one of the more dangerous highways.
Yeah, but
in the state.
You know, do your intervals on there. Yeah.
Ideally not.
Book it. Yeah, get off it as soon as possible. Yeah.
But anyway, I remember rolling up to the start line. I think there were like seven of us. And I just remember people talking about you. Like everywhere I turned, it seemed like someone was saying your name. And I was like, who is Lawson? And then
people are still saying who's Lawson, though. Yeah. That question is more prominent now than ever.
And so I remember kind of like keying off of you. And on the last lap, you attacked up that little climb. And I remember holding you pretty close. I was like, oh, I think maybe I can hang with this Lawson guy. And then I knew nothing about bike racing. And so I completely forgot about the fact that like staying close or staying in contact up the hill was not actually the bike race. Cause then you turned right and it was just another 5 miles of like flat
right,
and stuff.
Right.
And then you just did your now signature TT thing and you put like minutes into me across the finish line. And then you were just kind of hanging out at the finish and you were talking about the race you'd won earlier that day. Like oh, you'd God. Done the Cat 3 race. I was like, oh my God. Okay. So there's levels to this.
It's probably the last race I won though, to be honest.
Come on. Come on. We'll get into that. Anyway, that was a good first memory and our paths kind of went different directions after that. But I would love to, before we get to kind of present day stuff, can you kind of give us some background about your Texas roots, how you, I think what, was it Trek Livestrong that was kind of the next step for you after those junior? Well, you had Hot Tubes, Trek Livestrong.
No, I was, for sure. I was pretty fortunate just kind of with my path into cycling. I started out in the Velodrome in Houston, Alkek Velodrome. I was just kind of part of like the community there. And then I think when I was 15 is the first time I raced internationally. Went up to Canada, just did a 15-16 race up there and yeah, somehow that got me on the national team radar. Went to Europe for the first time when I was 16. Spent like 3 or 4 weeks there, and of course that's a big eye opener. But you're in the mecca of cycling, you know. You're immediately hooked, and yeah, you feel like you take a big step. So,
did you know what you were getting into? Like, were you a fan of the sport yet?
You think you are, but you have no idea what professional cycling is actually like. So yeah, we were going to Belgium. We spent three or four weeks in the national team house in Belgium, and you don't quite understand that, like, that's where the magic happens. You know, that's where, like, you know, Belgium's probably one of the best countries in the sport of cycling across all disciplines. You know, like, you don't realize that as a 16-year-old. You're pretty kind of just, like, in tune with your immediate surroundings. And back then, you know, social media and internet wasn't really a big thing. So you really just didn't know. And especially being American, you're just so shielded from true professional cycling. So yeah, that was kind of my experience. Of course, you have, like, you know, the big names in the sport, and you're kind of, like, naming, like, other riders, like, oh, like, that's a Mini Cancellara and yeah. Mini Boonen and stuff like that. You know, a guy in a you know, Belgian national champion jersey, and you're just like, oh yeah, these guys. So yeah, didn't really know what I was getting into, but of course, like, a lot of it's you're being told, like, this is your opportunity. You know, and so that's your kind of, like, your thought going over there. Of course, when you're 16, you're not taking it serious. You're eating Cocoa Puffs every morning or whatever Europeans version of them, like, smashing jars of a Nutella at a time. But yeah, in your mind, you're like, I'm doing it. but yeah, I mean, was able to get invited back on the national team. Somehow I made I guess I just didn't make enough of a bad impression that they invited me back. Yeah, and just kind of just got rolling from there. I made it onto Hot Tubes, which is directed by Toby Stanton. And yeah, when I look back, those are some of, like, the best years and memories I've got on a bike. You know, some of my closest friends now are still, you know, amongst those four or five guys that were on the team with me.
Yeah, so Hot Tubes still is kind of, like, one of, if not the most successful and well thought of development teams, junior
yeah
road racing teams in the country. Who were some of the other guys on that team that you're
mentioning? Yeah, so the guys on the team was Nathan Brown, Gavin Mannion, Ian Boswell. We had a Canadian, Stuart White, and me, and then we had a 15-16-year-old I think on the team. So there's only six of us, so it's kind of a small organization. But yeah, I don't know, we spend so much time together, so much time in Europe, you know, racing and training together. And training is a pretty loose term as a junior, at least it was back then. But yeah, we became so close, and then we all stayed within the sport, you know, and out of, you know, Nate, Gavin, Boz, and me, we all made it to the highest level of the sport. So we kind of had this just bond over that we were all still in the sport. We still are in the sport and been able to remain close. Yeah big cool. Shout out to Toby.
Yeah, that's cool. Yeah, and it's still rolling. Wasn't
for whatever
the talent
that's
come out of that program.
The last
crazy.
Couple of years, Toby he's kind of hit the gold mine, because he's at Magnus Sheffield, who's gone on to do some pretty incredible things in the World Tour. And then now he's got AJ August, who just moved to Ineos, and he's kind of the guy that everyone's talking about. So yeah, Toby, I mean, he's done a good job, and something I've talked about a lot in the past, but, like, Toby does such a good job of teaching these guys that are very impressionable age that, you know, the importance of teamwork, the importance of kind of just, like, you know, life as a whole instead of just cycling as a whole. So, and I think that's why there's been a lot of success out of the program. And that's both on and off the bike. You know, almost everyone that's gone through the program has a lot of respect for Toby and what he does for the current and past riders. So it's a special program to be a part of.
Yeah. Yeah. So in those early formative years, were you kind of just taking it year to year and, like, exploring what it meant and how good you could be and all that sort of thing? 'Cause the way you were sort of describing it to me the other day when we rode is that you didn't necessarily have this grand scheme to become a professional cyclist. It's almost like this detour that's taken up the first bit of your life. And So talk to me about your mindset. Like, did you want to be a professional athlete when you were a kiddo? Did you, like, just find that you took to the work ethic component and enjoyed the really hard work from a young age?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I guess there's kind of, we were talking the other day on the bike, and when I was a kid, I always wanted to go into the family business in Houston that my dad started, which is just a roofing company, small business. And you know, I skipped the whole, I want to be an astronaut, a fireman, blah, blah, blah. I want to be a roofer, you know? So, but yeah, I mean, cycling kind of took over my life. And I like to sit here and kind of act humble and whatnot and be like, oh, I was a 17-year-old, 18-year-old. Yeah. You know, I was just taking every day as it came, but I wanted to be a professional athlete. It was cool. You know, that's a cool thing to do is, you know, get paid to do a game or to play a sport, you know? And at the moment, you know, I was like, man, I'm going to be the best there ever was, you know, obviously my mindset has shifted a little bit over the last, you know, 10, 15 years. But it was kind of, yeah, once I started to have a little bit of success in the junior ranks and U23 ranks, I was like, oh man, I'm going to, you know, go straight into the world tour. I'm going to win the tour a couple of times. I don't have all the fancy life and I have all the cool stuff. But yeah, it's been a bit of a different path then. Not to say it hasn't been successful. Not to say I'm not proud of what I've done. But it took me a long time to kind of get to that point of yeah, you know, like there are more important things in my life than the bike. Obviously, cycling is a huge part of me and my family's life. But yeah, it's been a long journey. It's been my entire life, to be honest. And yeah, it's been a good one. I can't complain.
It's funny you mentioned that about the starry-eyed junior dreams, because I almost feel like as a junior racer, you have to have that. Just complete naive, blind optimism. Oh, like, I'm going to win the Olympics 4 times,
mm-hmm.
12 yellow jerseys, whatever. Just insane.
Four time over 16 years.
Yeah, exactly. Just absolutely absurd aspirations. Because if you knew, you know, what was more realistic for most, you probably wouldn't, you know, make the sacrifices as a 16, 17, 18-year-old that, you know, in hindsight are sacrifices, but at the time were not sacrifices. You were just super fired up to chase your dreams. And then once you kind of make it into the pro ranks, obviously you settle into this more like sustainable kind of mindset. But talk to me about, let's talk a little bit about kind of the bridge between those junior days when you were figuring out that you had talent and then where you are today. So kind of my understanding is was it Trek Livestrong back then?
Yeah. Yeah. It was a couple different names. When I first joined it, it was Trek Livestrong, out of the juniors. And that was the U23, the development team to be on, you know, they was directly linked to Lance. It was a direct feeder team to Radio Shack, which was big world tour team at the time. So
insane roster.
Yeah, exactly.
Who were your teammates those couple of years?
The first generation of Trek Livestrong had like the, you know, the Taylor Finney, Sam Buley, and kind of those guys, Alex Dowsett, guys that had long and successful careers in the world tour. When I joined the team, it was kind of a shift, but there's definitely a lot of talent that came out of that program. So I was back then I was teammates with same guys, Nate, Gavin, Boswell, all the guys that I'd been on hot tubes with. I was teammates with Dombrowski. He just retired the other day. He had incredible career, racing the world tour. Let's see, Stuyven.
Oh, really? That's crazy.
Jesper Stuyven, monument winner.
Yeah.
Jesper Du Bois races for Lotto Soudal. Also been really solid. The list goes on. I'm obviously blanking on a couple. But yeah, you look back on those times and honestly, you can look at all of Axel's alumni and just be like, well, geez. Our joke on the team was like, at some point we're just gonna have to build a Trek Livestrong alumni team.
Yeah,
in the world tour, cool. You know,
you guys should have a reunion of some kind,
right? Yeah, I was like, well, even like the riders on there were like, oh, we could just stack a, you know, pretty solid tour team right here. So but yeah, reunion would be sweet.
I mean, geez, a good handful of the guys are in Girona.
I know,
right now, like obviously Taylor's here,
mm-hmm.
a couple of the other guys. Cool. So You had some, we're sort of like flying through it, but you had some awesome results as a junior in U23. I think, did you podium Roubaix as a junior?
Yeah, as a junior. Yeah. I had no clue what I was going to get myself into. but I mean, junior Roubaix, and these are some of the best memories I have of being a junior in U23, but you get thrown into these incredible experiences that you don't know how to appreciate at the time. But junior Roubaix is held the same day as the professional race.
Oh, really?
And it's just a couple hours before.
Oh.
And so, of course, Roubaix is one of the biggest events in our sport. And people, the fans and everything, they just show up for, you know, a full day before, camper vans along the entire route. And of course, and I'm a 17-year-old, 18-year-old, and racing through the same roads just a couple hours before. And all the fans, you know, they're just screaming. They're so passionate about the sport. They know our names, you know, for whatever reason. And yeah, you come ripping in on the velodrome. The whole velodrome is packed and everyone's screaming. And then, yeah, I was in the group fighting for the win, finished on the podium. So, yeah, I was just somehow been on the podium on Roubaix Sunday. So, those moments like that are they stick with you, you know?
Yeah. That's cool. That's really cool. Yeah. And I want to talk about some of those moments in the pros in a few, but, okay. So talk us through kind of the timeline of your first pro contract. I know On Track Live Strong, you guys were getting paid, but you were not, in the world tour yet. So
yeah.
Was EF, it wouldn't have been EF at the time, but was that your first world tour contract?
No, I did 3 years with Trek Livestrong. And then I made the jump to the world tour and the team that I joined now is DSM.
Okay.
Something. Yeah. I don't know. Yeah. Whatever. Back then it was giant Shimano.
Yeah.
And then
that's right.
Giant
Alpecin. That's right. Yeah.
And a lot of people like kind of expected me to go to an American team, a team like Trek or BMC and whatnot. But at the time, Giant just came to me and kind of, they just laid it out. They're like, look, we believe in your talent. Like, we believe we can develop you into the rider that, you know, maximize all your potential, which is kind of what I was looking for. I knew I still had a lot of room to grow. Decided to choose that team and I was really fortunate, you know, it was a really tight knit group of guys, which is an environment that I feel like I thrive on. And it was an incredible place to learn how to be a professional. I was teammates with some of the top sprinters in the world at the time, Marcel Kittel and Degen Kolb and we had quite a few more, but also great climbers. Warren Barguil winning stages at Grand Tours. Tom Dumoulin, almost like at the time when I was on the team, almost winning Grand Tours.
Yeah,
so
crazy.
Yeah, like the team kind of threw me into the deep end, you know, and like put me on the sprint train, and then had me like doing like GC support for these guys. And so I was kind of just at first it was really tough, you know. It was like I felt like I had too much to try and absorb and learn, and it was beyond, in some ways, beyond my capabilities. But looking back now, I think it was the most beneficial 2 years of my entire career. I went to a team that, like, they didn't care about past results, they didn't care about future results, they only cared about developing each and every rider to the max that they could at that moment. And I think that's probably still true to their ethos. I think what I learned there, you know, being in these sprint trains and then learning how to fight for position and learning how to ride crosswinds a bit and learn how to, you know, be there in Grand Tours from guys that were, you know, coming close to winning. It was all a massive learning curve, but it taught me more. Those 2 years on that team taught me more than pretty much any other year of my career.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. That is really cool. Speaking of that transition though, cause you on Trek Livestrong, you were on an American team with a bunch of US guys that you'd been friends with literally since you were a junior.
Yeah.
Then you take this big step, officially living the dream, world tour team, doing the biggest races in the world. But I also know that you're a Texas boy that loves your barbecue.
Absolutely.
And Houston Texans and wide open spaces.
Oh yeah.
You love a good middle of the summer Austin, Texas training camp still to this day.
Yeah, still to this day, yeah.
So what was it like to transition into a European team and live in Europe the majority of the year?
It was tough. I'd be lying if I said it was smooth sailing. I got to the end of my first year on the team, and honestly, I was just like really started to question like what I actually want out of this. You know, what am I doing? The team, they didn't really care about me, like, you know, the fact that I was American and away from home. You know, they're like, this is kind of, you know, this is the job that you have to do, and you just have to figure out how to do it. And they provided some kind of support, but a lot of it was on my shoulders to figure it out. So when I first moved to Girona, it was just everything that needed to be done. I just had to, you know, work out how it should be done on my own, it felt like. And so a lot of times that was very daunting. I've been coming to Europe since I was 16. You know, at this point I'm 22, but I've never actually lived in Europe, and that's a whole different ball game. And so you don't realize, you know, as the very first night I moved to my apartment, I was stoked that I finally got it set up, and then, you know, realized I didn't buy toilet paper. So it's just so many moments like that, you know, and you're just, you know, I sit on the toilet, just lost. So yeah, RIP pair of socks, but and it was constantly just moments like that throughout the entire year that you just, yeah, you're taking two steps forward, one step back constantly. But you know, and I was, yeah, like you said earlier, I was on a new team. There's one American on the team, Tom Peterson, who's a lot of people forget about, but he's a legend. Yeah. Other than that, it was all Europeans, you know? So I had to actually learn how to embed myself within this organization and actually meet new people, get along with them and, you know, learn about their lives, you know, and kind of develop new relationships. I think that was also incredibly important, you know, going forward to the teams that I've been on since then. So, I remember my very first year I did the Vuelta España, and yeah, I thought it was going to be a hot shot that I was going to walk in and just like, you know, rip it. And sure enough, 2 weeks in, stage 14, I remember just being so empty. I just couldn't pedal. And all of a sudden I'm 20 minutes off the back, you know, trying to climb
solo or group
just by myself, beyond everyone, you know. And if I see this climb, I see this sign on the side of the road, it's like top of the climb, 20 kilometers or something.
Oh boy.
And I was like, no, I gotta keep going, and rode to the top of the climb. And finally the director just pulled me, like just came up to me and was like, dude, it's done, you know. At that point, wow. I'm 45 minutes behind the crew.
Out of time cut, yeah.
Still halfway through the stage, and it's just like, it's just no chance, you know. And of course, you're just crying, you're broken, you feel like your whole life has just like been thrown upside down in the moment. I remember getting home from that race. I had no family here. My girlfriend, wife now, she wasn't here, and so it was like I felt alone here in Girona. And yeah, you're trying to navigate as a 22-year-old, like, in a foreign country is this tough moment. Just trying to figure it out on your own. So I remember, did you remember getting to the end of that year just being, like, just so, so unhappy? But there's also a lot of hunger left into me, being like, I never want to feel that again. You know, I never want to go back to the Vuelta or Tour or Giro, whatever race. I remember how bad that was. Every year since then, there's been a lot of steps, a lot of lessons. And even now there's a lot of lessons, and granted my life has changed dramatically. Back then I was, just a dude, had a girlfriend back in the States, racing a bike at the top level. Now I'm 30 years old. I got a wife, I got two kids, you know? So it's been a long journey. There's been a lot of good moments, a lot of honestly really, really shit moments too. So, but yeah, kind of shapes you to who you are at this day. And, you know, I can be proud of that, I think.
Do you remember what your team said when you dropped out of that first Vuelta? Like, what was their response? Did they kind of leave it up to you to pull yourself up by your bootstraps and decide whether you were going to figure it out and rise to the occasion, or how did they handle that moment?
Yeah, I do remember getting home, and to me it was like everything in my life at the moment. But for them, I was just another rider amongst 30, you know, 30 on the men's team and then another 15 on the women's team. I was one person in an organization of 100 people in total, including staff, you know? So of course you get kind of lost. You feel, as an athlete, you feel entitled to, you know, be like, this is, I'm the show here, you know, I want to be taken care of, you know, but for them, they're like, well, we still got another week of important racing to go. And then we have these races, and then we have these races, and then we have these guys, and they're winning, you know? So yeah, of course you're kind of like, shoot, why aren't they checking in? You know, why am I not getting the support? But yeah, looking back now, of course it's tough. You know, you want all the support that you can have in the world. And in those moments, you kind of realize like, okay, like the support that I actually need is a support system that I'm going to have to build, you know?
Interesting. Yeah.
That comes from like the family. It comes from the really close friends. Those are the people that get you through the tough moments and ride with you through the great moments.
Interesting. Yeah. So what was your first breakthrough where you felt, because obviously that Vuelta made you feel like maybe you didn't belong. You had a lot of questions. What was the race where you said, okay, I've arrived and I belong in this peloton?
Yeah. I mean, honestly, probably, I think it was about a year later to the day. I remember being at the Vuelta again next, the year following. And of course I had changed all my training. I'd gone back to my original coach, Jim Miller. I had a point to prove. And at that Vuelta, we had Tom Dumoulin, who had been on fire the entire race. He was in the red jersey. He was in and out, you know, winning stages and stuff. And I remember hitting stage 14. I was like, oh man, this is where I cracked last year. I'm now heading into like uncharted territories, uncharted waters. So I remember we had this big mountaintop finish, and I was like, same thing. I just had a point to prove. So we got to the bottom and I was like, man, I'm doing it. I'm feeling amazing. I ended up like being like, you know, out of the peloton, like 11th or 12th out of the peloton on the stage. And then, you know, being right there with Tom until the final, like 300 or 400 meters. Wow. So I was like, at that point, I was like, okay, you know, like big difference from a year ago. Only one way to go now, you know. Of course it gives you that little taste of like, okay, I'm here, I belong. Of course, 2 days later, I had an awful day. I finished like the last on the road. But
that'll happen.
Yeah.
Do you remember what you changed about your training? Do you think that had a big impact?
Yeah. I mean, yeah. For me, training has always been, it's something that I really grew to love as my career went on. When I was a junior and U23, I loved just racing. That's all I wanted to do. I hated training. I did not want to get on the bike, you know, and you talk to some of the junior teammates that I had, and they were like, this guy had no work ethic. He didn't, he refused to train. Like 7 hours, 8 hours was a big week for him. Nowadays it's complete opposite. You know, I only race so I can train, it feels like. But yeah, when I was 21, I made the switch to Jim Miller as my coach. And yeah, when you look back on your life and your career, there's always just a handful of people that stand out as like, okay, without them, I'm nowhere. Jim for me is absolutely at the you know, very top of that list outside of my immediate family. But yeah, Jim, you know, he's just no bullshit. You know, he tells you exactly how it is. He takes a lot of pride in his work. And he kind of just proves to you, shows you how it should be done by example, not by telling you in a lot of ways. And that's something that, you know, when I was 21, I absolutely needed, you know. Yeah, so we started working closely together since then. My first year on John Alpecin, the team took over my training. At the end of that year, like I said earlier, I was done. So I just went back to Jim, and I was like, Jim, I need you back. You know, like we've done, like you've gotten the best out of me, like in the past. I know you can get the best out of me in the future. And of course, yeah, we started working together again, and it was kind of under the books. We kind of hid it from the team because, of course, they really like to control everything. Mm-hmm. Yep. It was funny. I would get my training from the team. I would send it to Jim, and Jim would just tinker with it a little
no
bit.
No way.
So that it would still look like I was still doing the team's training, wow, but I was actually doing Jim's training.
Crazy, man.
Yeah. It was sweet. And, you know, like, and I started, we took a year off, but I started to like continue developing that relationship with Jim.
Yeah.
And so, I had a great year in 2015 and then went to, what's now EF, back then it was Cannondale Pro Cycling, in 2016. And 2016 was kind of my big breakout year. I was still pretty young. I was like 24 or something. Can't remember. It doesn't matter. But at that point it was Jim and I were dynamic duo. You're like, you know, there was no hiding. He was my coach. That's how it was. And I came out and I was just firing on all cylinders. You know, I didn't fish out of like top 10 or top 15 the entire spring and every race I did. And these are some of the hardest races on the calendar. And
like, what were some of the races you top 10 and top 15?
So this is probably one of my proudest results, but I was ninth overall at Vuelta País Vasco, which is a race in the Basque Country. And it's just known for just being like one of the hardest races on the calendar. Hard, the weather is like snowing every day. It's entirely just like 25% climbs over and over and over again. And yeah, when I look back, I'm like, oh, I'm proud of that one. I think I was maybe 15th at Pyrenees, you know, another one of those early classic races.
So week long stage races.
Yeah. And interesting. At that point I was like, you know, I'm going to be a grand tour rider. You know, I'm going to keep developing, you know, I'm going to work on my weight, work on everything. And I'm going to be at the top of the sport. And yeah, it all kind of shifted. I was training for the Tour de France at the time. This is still 2016. And we went up to Andorra with the team. And it was kind of the 10 guys or 9 guys that were in the fight for the selection. And all of a sudden, team boss JV kind of rolls up and he's like, "Hey guys, this is the training that we're going to start doing." And he sort of told Jim, I was like, "Oh, hey, you know, team's doing the training, blah, blah, blah. You know, we're all at an altitude camp doing it together." And then, yeah, we started doing just insane stuff, just ridiculous stuff. 6-hour rides. And then, or like we do like 5-hour rides, a ton of intervals, come back and then rest for a little bit. We take our bikes and we go sit in a sauna on our bikes on a trainer and do another like 45 minutes. And like, it's just stuff like that, you know? And so of course at the time you're like, man, this, if I would thought I was training hard before,
yeah,
what I'm doing now is going to be, we're going to sweep the podium at the tour. Sure enough, we like halfway through the tour that year, like everyone's wheels fell off.
Wow. Interesting. Yeah.
And that kind of, I made it through the tour that year. That was my first tour. And then kind of just managed my way through the rest of the season. And then in the off season, got the phone call. It's like, JV is like, "Oh, hey, I'm going to take over your training." And I was just like, man, I was just, Jim has been like such a big part of like my career. And, you know, at that point he's like becoming just a mentor to me. You know, so I'm like, I had to make another phone call to Jim. I remember I was just like in tears, like, "Jim, like, they're breaking us up again." You know, it's just like, I don't want to do this. You know, the team, it's, you know, when the boss says this is going to happen. So, looking back, it's weird. You know, it's like, imagine like Robert Kraft going down to Belichick and just being like, "Hey, I got it this year," you know?
Yeah. Which is funny because you actually, there are examples in mainstream sports of owners or GMs just being way too hands-on with coaching or just, you know, roster construction, whatever it is. And it really throws things off. Like, teams go sideways for years.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it does happen in mainstream sports, but what you just said is a great example. Like, guarantee you Robert Kraft never told Belichick what plays to call.
Yeah. You would think so, right? So, but I mean, and JV, I mean, like, you cannot deny that the guy is so intelligent. Yeah. He's just a genius. Like, he knows so much and he is very smart. I will give him that, you know, like, you know, it's just when he was working with me as a coach to athlete perspective or relationship, I started to understand that it's more than just like, that relationship is more than just riding plans, you know, reading an article online or doing some scientific research and being like, okay, you know, like this worked in a lab, you know, if we do this and then this also worked in a lab, let's do that. And then this is kind of working over here. So let's just also add that. So it's like, that's a lot of what it was, but it was only like, that was the extent of the relationship. And it's not something that I felt comfortable in, really. You know, I never felt like I could pick up the phone call and be like, hey, JV, I'm struggling right now. Or like, you know, this is really too hard. Or
That's tough because, sorry to interrupt, but what just occurred to me is the conflict of interest component. Because he's also the guy that's signing off on your contracts, deciding on whether you get renewed, you know, all kinds of stuff.
Boss of the team.
Yeah.
Owner, you know, everything. So. But it, I mean, it was a big eye opener for me because, like, with Jim, I could call him up and be like, Jim, I had too much drink last night, you know? Because at the end, I just had the relationship with him, you know? It's just like, I you know, we're like, hey, dude, I'm mentally, I'm really struggling right now.
Yeah.
You know, like, I felt so comfortable, and I still do to this day, of telling Jim, like, exactly where I'm at.
Yep.
You know, and with Jim, we'd work on that together with JV. It was like, hey, this is the plan. This is what you're going to do. This is what's going to make you a champion, blah, 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 blah. Do it. You know, I remember the first time I texted him, like I had did all this training, had a terrible day. I was like, dude, I am destroyed right now. You know, good. It's working. You know, was his response, you know? And so like, of course now I feel obligated to just keep going. Yeah. I ended up digging myself into some ridiculous hole. And
this is
2017. And yeah, I had this, ridiculous hole. And basically I just had to take the year off, you know, from March on, the year was a wash.
I remember this. Cause I remember, you know, what's funny is this was when I think you were uploading pretty much everything to Strava.
Yeah.
And I've always been a fan of the sport for sure. Yeah. And, you know, I'm a super nerd when it comes to training and just seeing what riders are doing and all that sort of thing. And I remember you were, if I remember correctly, you were doing these crazy 3-day sessions at times with just like
3 days,
an absurd amount of tempo.
A typical day in that time, it was, I would go out 4 hours in the morning and 3 of those hours I'd have to do it like 300 watts and then come back. And then it was in the program, it was nap, you know? So sorry, babe, but I got to go sleep, you know, I've got an app an hour nap on the calendar. So I go take an hour nap. And then I would ride to the gym and I'd do like a full lifting session and I'd get back on the bike and I'd do intervals on the bike. And like looking back now, I'm like, I couldn't make it through 3 months, you know?
Wow.
I remember doing a ride with Lance and it was like a monster ride and it was like 6-7 hours. And I had like 4.5 hours that I had to do at 300.
Oh my God.
Lance was furious. He's just, we got done. He was like, dude, what are you doing? And I was like, bro, I was training hard.
Yeah.
You know? And then he was just like, he didn't call me an idiot, but he looked at me with those eyes and he was, you're an idiot. You know?
Yeah.
But, you know, of course, like, young guy, you know, I'm like Lance Armstrong sitting on my wheel suffering. This is sweet. I'm going to be so good. But.
Oh, man.
Yeah, it turns out I was an idiot.
So when did you go back to gym for the third time?
Yeah.
Or second time, I guess, going back?
Yeah, it would have been the third phone call I made to Jim. But, hey, you want to coach me again? and this is, I love Jim about this. Basically, it got to like late summer, I don't know, maybe August, and I was just like, JV, like it's just not working anymore, you know. And I think I gotta figure this out myself, you know. A couple hours later, I text the gym and be like, hey, what do you think about, you know, like, can you be my coach again? Nothing.
Uh oh.
Yeah. And so this is August. I'm like, I'm not worried. You know, I got to November or until I start training really for next year. At that point, the year was a wash anyway. So I was just kind of riding, hanging out in Austin, like, and I still had a couple races left. And then maybe about 6 weeks later, texting him again, like, hey, you want to get on the phone call? Nothing.
Whoa, crazy.
Yeah.
Huh.
And then finally it was like November. Like I had to like call him like 2 or 3 times. And I was like, dude, Jim, like, please, I need you. And he's like, I know you do.
Wow, interesting.
I love that about Jim. His you know, he'd always tell us just ruthless execution.
Yeah.
You know, and he takes that idea and mythology or whatever to his own work. We pick back up again into 2017, and ever since then I've had other people come up and be like, oh, even at the same time I had people coming to me and being like, hey, I want to coach you next year. I know you've had a rough year, you know, but I can fix you. And that's what a lot of them said. But I just remember thinking, I'm like, I'm not broken. You know,
interesting.
You know, Jim didn't think I was like when I called Jim, he didn't think I was broken. He knew exactly who I was. He knew exactly what I needed to do going forward. And that's kind of when, you know, in 2017 and ever since then, I've never had another coach.
Yeah. Refuse. Yeah. You know, what's interesting to me, what all of this kind of just reinforces is the importance of it being a good match.
Yeah.
Because Jim gives those sort of crazy, like, Fat Max rides to Quinn and Keegan sometimes, where they just sit on 300, mm-hmm. Quinn's case 300 plus,
right? Yeah,
for 4+ hours. Yeah. So he gives some of those guys, at least some of the time, like absolutely insane training. But obviously, that's not going to work for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
Granted, he's probably not having them go to the gym after and right. then do intervals in the evening
and also on top of it, but yeah, not eating carbs and all that stuff.
Oh, that phase. Whew, I'm glad we've moved on from that as a sport.
Yeah.
Okay. I want to talk about 2018 tour.
Yeah.
Cause that was a pretty interesting story. Nicole and I, this morning, we found a little video. It was actually on NPR.
Mm.
Where you're doing an interview. What stage did you crash?
Stage one.
Stage one. Okay. Yeah. And you're doing this interview and you're clearly just super down in the dumps, in pain. And you said something like, I've worked too hard and I've come too far to quit now. You quit now and you just break down.
Yeah.
And we both got teary eyed. Like, it was so emotional. Yeah. We were just like, oh man. And this happened 6 years ago.
Yeah.
And still, like, knowing, obviously not knowing what it's like to train for the tour and do the tour, but knowing what it's like to work really hard for a goal and then kind of have it taken away from you. Like, it tore my heart out all over again. And it was, I wasn't even the one that it was happening to. So take us inside what happened. And then obviously it unfolded in a more positive way over the coming weeks. But I mean, that was that's like in cycling legend that year.
Yeah. I mean, 2018, stage one of the Tour de France, and this is coming off the tail ends of 2017, where everything went wrong, and I had one goal in mind that year, is just make it back to the Tour. I didn't have the Tour I wanted in 2016, so it was just like I was on this whole redemption, you know, just that's all I wanted. I wanted back at the Tour, I wanted to be racing at my top level fitness, and I wanted to show the world what I had. And yeah, didn't really get the chance. Halfway through the stage in the feed zone, crashed, and I ended up fracturing my shoulder blade and had to get a bunch of stitches in my eye, and I just remember, I was just like, man, everything that I feel like this last like 2 years have built up to is just done now. It's just gone. And I remember getting done with the stage, and it was such a hard pill to swallow. And of course you hear I've got a broken bone, no chance of continuing. And so that's when, you know, I was doing the interview and just couldn't handle it. You know, I had so much disappointment the year before. I was still trying to build my way back up. I felt like I was finally there, and then it was just over. Fortunately, I had a great doctor, a guy I'm still friends with today, Kevin Sprouse. And I don't know if he's trying to make me feel better, but he was like, oh man, it's a spine of scapula. It's a small fracture. It's like, it's almost like having like a really bad broken toe. And I was just like, what does that mean? He was like, you know, you'd still go and work if you had a broken toe, you know? And I was like, so you're telling me I can still race? You know, and this was after we got back to the hotel, and I was like, well, shoot, if there's a chance, I'm going to do it. Meanwhile, I cannot lift my arm like halfway up. But I was like, well, if you say I can race, I'm going to do it. then I was laying in bed. I was in a lot of pain. I was like, well, shoot, if I'm going to race, like, I need motivation, you know? And I was already doing a fundraiser for the Alcake Velodrome with a pair of shoes I was going to auction off. And I was like, what? I'm here, you know?
This is the Velodrome you grew up racing in.
Yeah. And they'd kind of had a lot of damage from Hurricane Harvey a couple months before. And yeah, so I was like, well, shoot, might as well. I don't know if I'll be here even when the auction starts. It's supposed to start in the second week. So I was like, might as well just get this ball rolling. So I just got on Twitter and I was just like, hey, if I don't know what I'll be able to do, but it, you know, every day I finish, I'll donate $100 to the Velodrome, just help them repair and everything. And kind of went to bed, put the phone down. And the next morning it was just, I was like, whoa, went viral.
Wow.
Got my social media presence and I haven't worked on it ever since.
That was your peak.
Yeah.
It was a high peak to be fair. How much did you end up raising?
So yeah, the GoFundMe, between the GoFundMe and we did another fundraiser at the Velodrome, we ended up raising like $380,000.
Oh my God, which Lawson.
It's insane. Especially for the Velodrome.
Wow.
Operated on a $10,000 annual budget.
Oh my God.
For 15 years, you know? So it's like,
wow.
It was incredible. And for me, that was the biggest shift in my career.
Hmm.
You know, that 3 weeks of the tour, you know, like I showed up wanting to blow everyone's doors off with my performance. Then I got to the end. I remember we're flying into Paris and, you know, we're getting close. I can see Paris and like, you know, on the ground, I see the Eiffel Tower. I'm just like thinking, I'm like, I made it, you know? But I was also thinking, I was like, now I have, this is like the most satisfaction I've ever felt in my life.
Wow.
And I was dead last in the race. You know, it was like my most memorable performance on a bike was the worst performance I've ever had, you know? But I was just like, I found joy in actually just like doing something, helping others, you know, not really doing it for myself. Huh. You know, at the time my wife was pregnant. So we were starting a family. And I was just like, yeah, maybe that time in my career of like, oh, you know, winning is the end all be all. Like,
huh.
I don't get that anymore, you know? And granted, yeah, I still do try and get everything I can out of myself on the bike and training and racing, but I'm just, it doesn't feel like it's my purpose, you know? And so there's almost like a tale of two careers, like before then and then after then. And I can tell you, I've enjoyed the second part of that much more.
Wow. Wow. That's crazy. That's really interesting. It's a really nice story, but I do have to ask, how much did it actually suck?
Oh, I mean, yeah, I'll never do it again. You know, like Velodrome's fine, right? I hope so.
The Velodrome's good for a while.
Yeah, right?
Maybe a couple hurricanes.
Yeah. I remember getting done. I was just like, man, if I ever like stub a toe, you know, jam a finger at a race, I'm pulling out. I am done. I'm not going through
that
again.
Were you ever close to missing time cut on any of the days?
I don't know if I was really close to missing time cut. And to me, this kind of shows you the power of the mind. Like once I started, like quitting was never an option. And so it was every day I got on that bike, it was like, no matter what, I'm getting to that finish.
Mm.
There's days that I've never suffered more in my entire life than I have in those 3 weeks.
Wow.
So many days where I'm just dangling and I'm just, yeah, just barely making it through, and it's just like holding on to Gruppetto and yeah, I've got a broken shoulder, I can't hold on to the car.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so it's like, yeah. So I mean, I just there's no other option except making it through. I think the closest day that I had to pull out, there's probably two actually. One was before the second rest day. Long story short, like my shoulder just seized up going into the final climb, and I just had to stop and like work it out, and the race exploded on the climb. So I was behind the Gruppetto, but the peloton was also is like 15 minutes, 20 minutes behind the breakaway.
Okay.
It was one of those days where they just let the breakaway go. So, which is fine. You know, it's an easy day in the peloton, but we start racing on the final climb and like all of a sudden, if I was in the front group, I would have had 20, 25 minutes to lose on this climb.
Yeah.
But I only had 5.
Oh.
You know? And so I'm like, and I'm stopped on the side of the road and just fully panic station. And just like, all of a sudden it just like goes into, mine just goes into full throttle and somehow was able to make it back. And make it back to the gruppetto and then ended up getting dropped again 2K from the line. Just like, but I remember getting done. I was just like borderline in tears. And just
Yeah. So just quick clarification. Basically, you have to finish within a certain percentage of the winner on any given stage.
Just to start the next.
Yeah. Or you get time cut and it's the winner. So if the Peloton gives the break 15 minutes, then you have 15 minutes less to play with.
Yeah.
Okay. So fast forwarding kind of to present day, different kind of into the spectrum here. And speaking of, it's funny you mentioned the break got 15 minutes. Mm. Breaks don't get 15 minutes anymore. No. So you started cycling, you started your career in the World Tour long enough ago that you've seen huge transformation in terms of how the races play out. It feels like with guys like Pogacar and some of the other races, like everyone wants to go for the stage every day. Like every GC rider is just gluttonous and like has to go for everything. So a lot of times the breaks get really short leashes. Mm-hmm. You had a stellar ride at the Tour this year. Was it stage 15?
Yeah, right for the second rest day. Yeah. Something like that. It all blurs together.
Hell of a break. I think Wout was in there. Is that right?
Yeah.
And it was pretty big break, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, it was about 25 guys. And yeah, the only thing that saved us was Sepp Kuss, I think. And,
with his crash?
Yeah.
Yeah, when he got taken out by the fan.
Yeah, because like I think like 2 days before, the day before, it was the same thing. And like Jumbo just... their step above everyone. Then they just set the tone. They're like, we want to put our stamp on this race. You know, we want to put our, you know, feet on everyone's throat. And, but 2 days before, same thing, we got a big break. It was exactly the situation we wanted. And, you know, we start getting away and all of a sudden like, oh, hey, on the radio, Jumbo's riding, you know, and they're just going nuclear. They give us like a minute, you know. Of course, in the break, you know, you're also just like, you want to stay away. So you're also going insane, you know? And so, similar thing happened on that stage was, we get away and then seriously, like the second we got a minute, we just get on someone on the radio is like, hey, Jumbo's riding again. You know, it wasn't even like, oh no, Jumbo. It was just like, yeah, Jumbo's riding again. You know, it's just like, oh, here we go. Yeah.
Mentally, that's just gotta be so frustrating.
Yeah. And you're just like, man, like these breaks are so hard to make it into, you know, there's a reason why you get in these big mountain stages and it's almost like the same 10 or 15 guys that get into these breaks.
True.
You know, it's because they're the only guys that at that point are capable of stepping out of the Peloton and going.
Yep.
So fortunately somehow by the grace of God, I made in that break again. And then, Jumbo starts riding and then big crash in Peloton. Guy steps out, just decks Sepp for whatever reason. I may have given him $100. I don't know. But. So
try riding now, Jumbo.
We got lucky, you know, the breaking up, getting away, and we had a big time gap. And I think that, points like that, you know, we're sitting in this break and we've been full throttle all day. You know, every climb you're doing 400 watts or whatever, not to get a numbers game, but like you're just riding on your limit. And then we get to the top of like the second last climb. And like, I've been sitting like 45 minutes at the threshold, just like fully pinned. And then I just see Van Aert just like at the very top, he just kind of like gets down in his drops and you're like, oh, that's weird. You know? And then he just kind of like pulls over to the side and then he just like looks back at everyone. And then at that moment you realize like, oh shit, you know? And then he just went, dude. And all of a sudden we're like, he goes from like 10K an hour to like 45K an hour, just like in the span of like 3 seconds. And you're like, that's cool. Yeah. Good for you, dude. I'm really just continue to suffer back here. And then, they ended up with a couple guys and I think there was two or three of them in the front. And then, I just, fortunately the team gave me the freedom to kind of do my own race. And I had the chance to do something at the Tour and I would have loved to be on the podium. Probably didn't play my cards exactly right, but I ended up, you know, I'm sitting there on the final climb of this race and Thibaut Pinot and Mikel Landa, the guys that won huge races in the past. And
The only guys that beat you that day were Thibaut, Landa, and Wout, right?
No, I put them to the sword.
Did you?
Yeah.
Who was 1, 2, 3? Because you were fourth.
It was Wout Poels won.
It was a huge second. Summit finish.
Yeah.
Wout Poels danced. Who, by the way, kind of interesting. I liked that he he got some good shine during the tour because everyone was like, man, this guy's been so good for so long.
I know.
And he's just had to be an absolute insane super domestique for Froome and all the other guys. And finally he gets to ride for himself kind of to his full potential. So in a way that was cool to see.
Yeah, would have
been
sure.
better if you won, but.
Right. But I mean, look at it. Like I had a great ride, but still, like if I go to the bottom of climb with route pulls, I know where I stand, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it's the beauty of the sport. You know, it's like the tour is like, it's just a different race every single day. You know, you really never know what's going to happen that day. And I think that's what's so special about it. And just had, I feel.
Wout was second. Who was third that day?
French guy, Bergado or something like that. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Not bad, dude. After performances like that, so you're 31, you turn 32 in a couple weeks, right?
Mm-hmm.
After performances like that, because I know you have such a distinct appreciation for, you know, being a good dad, being a good husband, being a proud Texan, wanting to work in the family business.
Yeah.
Like these are things we talked about the other day. But after just doing battle on the biggest stage like that and having an incredible ride and being in the, you know, top 1-2% of the Tour de France peloton. Like you were saying, you're one of 10 or 15 guys that were consistently proving you were strong enough to get in the breakaways deep in the race. What's that like push pull like right now? Cause I know you're thinking about what's next, but you're so goddamn good still, man. Like it really, like it's really cool to see.
I appreciate that. No, I mean, as years go on, your priorities start to, what's important to you starts to come to the front, you know, and sitting here, this is my 11th year in the Peloton racing and I can confidently say, and this happened basically the second I got married and had kids, but like it's been like family, you know, faith and Texas. No, I mean, it's cycling's probably third, you know, it is one of those things where, My family and who I am at home is by far more important than who I am on the bike. That's who I care about, you know, and in a lot of ways I think it's probably helped me on the bike. I feel like it's funny, I've had this conversation a couple times in the last couple of weeks. We're talking about just like, you start to get a point where you stop thinking about cycling so much that it actually benefits you.
Mm.
And I was just like, I kind of hit that point in 2018 when I had my first kid, you know, it's just like when I was on the bike, it was 100% focused to being on the bike, to training, to what I could do best to race. When I got home, that was over, you know, it was just like, here's a baby, keep it alive, you know? And so like that's where your mind's at, you know, every second you're not on the bike, you know? And so it's definitely afforded me like the balance that I think at least I've needed, to continue racing and to continue living in Europe and making this a career. It's definitely getting tougher. You know, my kids are in October, they turn 5 and 3, you know, at some point, not that we can go back and forth all that like easily now, but at some point you assume my daughter's going to start kindergarten all of a sudden, like, you know, we have summer break and Christmas break, you know, so it's like, where do we want to be? So
what's your split like right now between Girona and Austin?
So, I mean, last year, 2023, we flew over middle of January and then we flew back home November 11th. So,
And
then, this year, and then
came 9 back months home. In Europe.
Yeah. And we're very fortunate. We have a really good support system here and our kids go to a fantastic school. And that gives us a big break too. So it's like, it allows us to be present with our kids, but also for my wife and I to work on our relationship too. Cause that's also tough when you first have kids, you know,
you
forget to, I don't know, not that you forget who you're married to, but you're all of your focus is now on your kid and instead of each other. And so we also have had to find that balance of like, okay, you know, kids, marriage, you know, we can find a way that they're separate but also work harmoniously.
Yep.
I don't know if that's a word or not. But so, yeah, not to say we're perfect at it. You know, we still screw it up all the time. But we're doing well. We're in a good spot now. We're happy to be back here in Girona for another year, for year 11, living here. And yeah, we're excited to see what the future holds for us. That's for sure.
Cool, man. Well, we need to get out of here. This flew by, and I think I got through about 25% of my list, as happens. But
this is great.
Yeah, man. We should do another one.
Yeah.
Before I take off.
How do you like Girona?
We love it.
Yeah.
We really love it. It's just easy, you know? Yeah. And I think for us too, like, you've been training on these roads for over a decade now.
Not the gravel roads, so, yeah.
True, yeah. True. Yeah, okay, so... Super loaded question here. When you decide to step away from the world tour, are we going to see you continuing to race, potentially a little bit off-road? Or,
man, so here's for the Texas homies. I've never won Lago Vista.
Oh, dang. Really?
Yeah, so I might keep it going to try and make a run at La Primavera.
Dang.
Lago Vista is, like, you know, the marquee event of Texas spring racing. So,
dude, I've won that race.
Oh, gosh.
It was in the
You're on the
three,
list. But. I've got a Cat 3 story about that race. I should have won.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't know if we have much time, but we'll run through it.
Yeah.
I attacked on the last lap. I'm like 15 years old, Cat 3s, and this one guy, like, he just tags along with me, and we're going up the hill, and I've just got this guy on the limit, and he's just squealing back there, slow down, slow down. I was like, what? But I was like, dude, if you're just going to sit on, you got to give me the win. And he's like, that's fine. That's fine. You can have the win. You can have the win. And so, like, literally, I'm in junior gears. We get to the top, and, you know, and that course is, like, it's half uphill, half downhill.
Yep. And steep, I'm like, up, but then, like, falls flat down.
Yeah. And yeah. I'm in junior gears, spinning my little heart out, you know, on the downhill. And then, yeah, we get to the finish, and I'm like, well, you said I could win. Yeah. You know, so I'm going up the finish line hill, and I see my dad, and I'm smiling. I'm, like, giving a thumbs up.
Yeah.
20 meters before the line, he just decides. He's like, nah, no, deals way. Off.
No way.
Pips me. Couldn't what? Believe it. I didn't even call sprint.
Who was this? Can't remember his name. Yeah, well.
I can't remember his name. He's dead. No, he's dead to me. Life. That's why I can't remember his name. He's dead to me.
He knows.
He knows. Yeah, he knows for sure. What is his name? Yeah, I can't remember.
That's brutal.
Yeah. But no, back to your question. No, bikes will always be a part of my life, you know, and they've always have been and always will. So when I'm done racing, yeah, I plan on moving back to Houston. And I think the Houston cycling community is one of the strongest out
yeah,
there.
Yeah, absolutely.
So for whatever reason, like, the riding there is shit. But I think it brings everyone so much closer together. So every weekend you have probably 5-6 group rides that all have over 100 people. It's pretty special.
Wow.
So I'm excited to go to Houston and be a part of that, you know, go back to the track. You know, it's been a long time since I've been out to the Velodrome and spent time getting to know the people out there. So yeah, a lot of stuff in my future that I'm definitely excited about.
Cool, man. All right. Well, next time we're going to have to talk about your sick ride, your amazing vehicle that you purchased here.
Yeah.
We'll have to talk about Girona culinary scene.
Man. Go on and on.
Leadville 100.
I know. That's on the bucket list.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We've got plenty more to talk about. All right.
Yeah.
We'll do it in the studio next time. Thanks, Lawson. That was fun.
Yeah, thanks.
Talk to you later.
Hello again, everyone. Thank you so much for listening today. Hope you enjoyed that conversation with Lawson Craddock. I also want to say a big thank you to Lily McKelvin for editing and producing this show each and every week. We're uploading full-length episodes now on YouTube, not every week. This week with Lawson, like I said, our setup was just, our routine was thrown off a little bit by not having that normal studio, so we weren't able to get two camera angles to upload the full episode to YouTube, but we did still get some social clips, so you can go to our Instagram account, The Adventure Stash, to get a little bit of video of today's conversation. And we may upload a couple of, like, YouTube shorts to YouTube as well from this conversation. But as always, you can go to the Instagram, The Adventure Stash, to check out that content as well as our Friday quizzes. And then the YouTube is just my full name. I also want to say a big thank you to Nicole Baker, my partner, for putting up with my insane schedule and combining it with her insane schedule. She's in grad school right now at Johns Hopkins, which is absolutely full throttle, but she still finds the time to help me with the logistics and production of these shows. She's the one capturing the video content along with scheduling the recording locations and helping schedule the guests, and not to mention helping me talk through potential questions and conversation topics. I absolutely could not do this podcast without Lily and Nicole at this point. So a huge thanks to them. And lastly, a big thanks to all of y'all for continuing to listen each and every week. Please send us your ideas, your feedback. You can email us at theadventurestash@paysonmckelvin.com or shoot us a DM at the Instagram. All right, we'll catch you next week.